Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Justin Dillon is a musician turned filmmaker and social entrepreneur. He's the founder and CEO of Made in a Free World and the platform he also helped develop with the State Department, slaveryfootprint.org. Helps everyday people understand not just the cost, but every consumer's relationship to modern day slavery. It asks a pretty basic question. How many slaves work for you? I got 58. Justin's new book is called A Selfish Plan to Save the World, Finding Big Purpose in Big Problems. It's not just his story and how he came to be in this world, but also his ideas about how he thinks everyone can make a difference. Hey, Justin, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about this.
So your life plan was to be a musician, and that happened.
It did.
And can you take me to the moment where you are recording something and you step out from a studio and you see this article about Cambodia and modern slavery?
Yeah, I got to do my dream, which was to play music all around the world and make records and do all that. And about 12 years ago, I was making a record in L.A. And making a record is very broken up. It's not everyone playing all the time. So my part was done, and I went out to the lobby, and there was a New York Times article on the I can still see it on the coffee table that said the new sex trade. And of course, that sounds like that title was very interesting. I opened it up and read this article, and I'm reading about what a lot of people know about today is modern day slavery and sex trafficking and even some labor slavery. 12 years ago, 13 years ago, no one really knew about it. So I felt like I was reading something alone in a studio, and that everybody should hear about it. And in fact, it should be broadcast everywhere. And it really captured my heart in a way that nothing else ever had. And I tried to figure out a way to get involved, and I called nonprofits and expressed my interest in being able to help them. And
you did the thing everyone does,
right?
Yeah, which everyone
thinks
I want
to
help.
Yeah.
Maybe I should give money.
Yeah.
Maybe I should volunteer for something.
Well, I did what a lot of people do for me almost every day now is emailing me and saying, how can I get involved?
Right.
And so that's why I wrote this book.
And so you did get involved in another way. You decided to make a film about this.
I did. What I realized is what was inside of me, my desire to help, was not being satiated by the activities that were being handed to me.
Because you did do that, right? You did do,
how can I
get involved?
I did raise money for, that was what I was asked to do. Like, very small nonprofits were like, just raise some money for us to go do concerts. We did that. It was awesome. Wrote songs. But it was bigger. It was something more in me. I wanted to participate with not just what I could raise or how much I could give, but what I can do. And I'm finding that that's becoming more and more common. People want to apply who they are to the world's problems, not just what they can give. And so I didn't have a map, and so I had to make my own map. And the first step into my map was to look around my surroundings, which was the music community, and try to figure out how to, you know, configure that to be meaningful. And that's what led to creating a rockumentary film. I think it might be the first rockumentary film and maybe the last. A rockumentary documentary about human trafficking called Call and Response.
And so you write about this in the book, that you found a problem, you realized that you had a passion for it, and then you kind of figured out a path for yourself, which for you was so it was creativity, right? Was this whole idea of, that was kind of the idea behind the film. Like, you're an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to use art to try to talk about this.
That's it. So it's very natural, right? It's just, what's not natural is when you see problems in the world to think that what you're already good at might be helpful. That's not a natural, normal thought. And that's what I'm trying to help.
Yeah. Why do you think that? Because I think, and you write about this in the book, why do you think that we tend to think, well, I'm not working for, you know, the International Refugee Committee of the Red Cross,
right.
I'm not a pastor or some other religious leader or someone who's a humanitarian aid worker, so I can't really do anything.
Yeah, well, that was me. I thought the same thing. But what was inside of me still rocked me and still disturbed me and hijacked me. And so I kind of had to get over my own disqualifications that I would put on myself to be able to change the world. What I found is that no one's actually qualified to change the world. No one's authorized to change the world. We're all authorized. We all have the ability. In fact, what I've learned in my research and also just through my own experience is anyone who wants to change the world initially is not necessarily very qualified to do so. It's the ones, like Steve Jobs says, the crazy ones that are the ones that actually change the world. If you just start walking towards that, and you might find that you might change the world in some degree.
So your crazy was that you end up all over the world with different folks. Like, you're in Haiti with Common, you're in India looking, you know, and you're looking particularly, you're trying to find and document examples of child labor, slavery, and of child labor, of slavery, of all of those things. How did you come to the, I mean, as musicians always tell stories, right? Mm-hmm. How did you come to the idea of this film needs to have both music and stories of these kids in particular?
Well, music is certainly stories, but it's also performances is getting an audience to participate. Performance, when an artist performs, they're taking what's inside of them and asking an audience to come with them and physically participate in what's inside of them, taking them to another world. That's essentially, that was what I knew how to do. That was my trade. And so trying to articulate that, and quite frankly, for the last 10 years, I haven't been a musician for 10 years, I've been doing that same thing. It's just found its way into, I've been trying to take what's inside of me and getting people to participate it and own it for themselves, whether it's a song or a movie or a website or enterprise software.
Right. And so you note, actually, and we should, and I wanted to, it's an important place to kind of also begin with our conversation, that definitions of things are really important. Mm. President Obama was defining,
yes.
You're right about a moment you are at the Clinton Global Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama is talking about modern day slavery.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as you said, we are in a different place than we were 12 years
That's
ago,
right?
Yeah. But I think we do, when we think human trafficking, I think we either think sex workers or kids.
Yeah.
So how should we think about human trafficking, and how should we define modern day slavery?
One of the greatest contributions that President Obama gave to the modern day slavery movement was giving it permission to call itself slavery. And in his speech at the Clinton Global Initiative in 2012, he was very clear, and I encourage everyone to listen to it. He was very clear that slavery is indeed sex trafficking, child sex trafficking, but it's also a man who gets kidnapped in Cambodia and ends up on a Thai fishing vessel that goes out to fish for the prawns that end up on our salad. It's also young kids in Uzbekistan who the buses come up in the middle of school, takes them off to the fields and makes them work so that we can have shirts on our back. You know, slavery is defined by anyone who's forced to work without pay, under threat of violence, and unable to walk away. And by that definition, which is a pretty strong definition, it's over 40 million people that are facing that today.
And so for those of us who feel very removed from this, I think it does seem like this is, and you write about this, it seems like this is an insurmountable problem. There's this is too complex a problem. There's too many systems and cultures and other things involved with this for us to think about.
Well, as Dr. Cornel West says, I'm a prisoner of hope. And I actually, and I'm also an opportunist. And I actually think that the problems that we're solving today, you know, like transportation, going to Mars, we can solve all kinds of problems pretty well within the realm of possibility. And more than any other time in history, what is, and a lot of folks will say that globalization has exacerbated slavery, and that's true to a certain extent, but it's also our tool to fix it.
And do you think it's also for us a question of not looking at it as us versus them? I mean, how much of this is looking at the connections that we have with people? As we're thinking about all of this, as we're thinking about how we can help someone, what we can do, how we can get involved, do you think part of it needs to be sort of a reframing of even looking at our relation to the problem?
At a certain level, I think it's important to understand that slavery is a behavior. It's a business. Sometimes I define it as poverty with the bottom dropped out of it. So it's not necessarily the go-to choice to get things done. And I don't think it's, I think sometimes we think of it as a very sophisticated network. I haven't seen it as such. It's fantastically profitable, but it's not as organized as one thinks. And so it's a behavior that in a lot of cases, poor people take on to exploit other poor people. And so we need to look at it through all lenses, not just a moral lens, but an economic lens as well. And maybe even looking at why, if in fact, if there is some ways we might be inadvertently contributing to the problem. That's why we created Slavery Footprint with the State Department. We called it empirical performance art, which was a way to be able to help consumers understand their own participation in this, even though they don't know. And just knowing, getting to the point you said, how many slaves
right,
work
58.
For you? So just knowing, I believe that that is progress. I think some people feel very disarmed and very overwhelmed by that, because when you hear that number, the first thing you want to do is like, how do I get that down?
Right. So and let's explain how that works for Slavery Footprint. So I went in and I was doing there's sort of this online, it's kind of like a quiz or a game. It's a huge interaction. And I was able to sort of go through my lifestyle, whether it's food or material possessions or the recreational activities that I do. And then you guys have...
All branded, not one brand on there.
No.
So we don't get to point at anyone. We just said we're talking to ourselves. Yeah.
And then you attach data and facts and figures. And we look at particularly, and I think obviously technology has gotten a focus.
Because
I think there's been a lot of media and understanding about technology and the supply chain there.
Yeah.
What for you, had a point, I wonder if you could share the story of when you just sort of were like, I'm just going to email Steve Jobs and ask him about what's going on with what's in an iPhone.
This was back in 2008. And everything we've ever done, my team and I, it's always been to help and to democratize participation. So it's one thing to kind of, you know, be an activist and require a bunch of energy and steam to go, you know, tear down a wall. It's another thing to just kind of put a mirror up to society, to ourselves, and go, gosh, how can we know these things, and how can we build some steps to move forward? And one of the ways that we were just curious if consumers were interested in talking to the brands that they like and letting them know their own footprint. And to test that, we asked Steve, we wanted to know, and we wanted companies to know, that we're trying to bring data, not division. Like, we wanted the marketplace to fix this. And the typical way, you know, the typical activist move is to have consumers, you know, get
boycotted.
Which I don't believe I talk about in the book. It doesn't work anymore.
You don't think that works.
It doesn't. We have to use the marketplace and how it works. We have to make the marketplace work better. And sometimes that means we can't choose the cathartic response of hating the one you love, like the things that you use, and being upset about it. That's just catharsis. It goes nowhere. So our interest was, how can we create a conversation that happens between consumers and brands? And so I beta tested it on Steve Jobs.
And his response?
Well, we sent an email that said, hey, Steve, do you know about slavery in the iPhone? Is, you know, this challenge with the minerals out of Colton? I didn't expect. I mean, you know, it's Steve Jobs. But 4 hours later, I got an email back that says, I had no idea. I'll look into it, Steve, with a little hashtag at the bottom. Or not hashtag, but slash, sent from my iPhone, which I thought was funny.
So that's your story. That's Justin Dillon, founder and CEO of Made in a Free World, slaveryfootprint.org. How do you kind of connect that to what you write in the book, which is that maybe everyone doesn't change their career? Like, that's kind of your whole point of this book, right? Not everyone's going to be you.
Absolutely not. Please don't. Yeah.
So then what do you want everyone to be instead?
I want everyone to know that there is a story that's written over their lives that's a hero's journey, and that we find out who we are, as Dr. King said, when we give ourselves away to others. And it doesn't have to be changing careers or going to Haiti or taking on some big, huge problem. It could be challenges in your neighborhood. It could just be something that's happening in your community. I feel like the last 10 years of my life, I've been introduced to like a secret backdoor to meaning. By getting to participate in problems that never directly affect my life, slavery has never directly interrupted any part of my life. The exercise of taking on other people's problems, what I found is that it produces something that, quite frankly, comfort, acquisition, and attainment can't, and that's purpose. And I think that's something that we're missing a lot of now. And there's a sense of helplessness, and there's a sense of, how do I contribute? How do I help change the world? We're having a national conversation just about every 5 minutes. And I want people to understand that they have everything inside of them that can to change the world. And the book shows them where all those things are already inside of you.
Are you encouraged by what has happened in, you know, I wonder if you find, you said you hope is sort of, you're kind of an optimist. And do you find that the activism, what we've seen across the country in the past couple of months, do you think that's encouraging? I'm wondering.
I mean, it's early, but I think that people are finding their voice and finding out who they are and finding something bigger to stand up for, no matter what that is, no matter what side of the political spectrum.
Sure.
And I think that that's that's incredibly encouraging, because the first chapter of the book is called Find Your Riot. And that doesn't necessarily mean go riot. It means that every one of us has something inside of us that we want to see changed in the world. For me, it was slavery. For you, it might be something different. For listeners, something different as well. But everyone has something unique that they can contribute to the world and something they might want to see changed. But like me, initially, don't have the steps to get there. I mean, they may not have much to donate or always feel like they're not donating enough, but they have skills and time and networks. And so this book is a way to kind of help leverage all of that to be able to create the change in the world that we all want to see.
Justin's new book is called A Selfish Plan to Change the World, Finding Big Purpose in Big Problems. It's not just his story, but his ideas about how he thinks everyone can make a difference. Justin, thanks for being here.
Thanks
really
for having me.
It.
Yeah.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode.
From the might of the earth, and he breathed in his face the breath of his.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's the story of Adam and Eve become new again in the form of a very old piece of theater. The play of Adam is one of the oldest European medieval comic dramas that we're aware of. It takes you from the story of the Garden of Eden all the way up to the Christmas story. It was written in the vernacular, and this modern adaptation, translated and written by University of Illinois history professor Carol Symes. In studio with me now is Carol Symes, along with Kyle A. Thomas, the stage director, and Drew Minter, the play's music director and composer. Carol, Kyle, Drew, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Carol, so this is the oldest European play we know of in vernacular, the language of the people. How long did it take you to adapt this to today's language, to modern times?
Oh, I spent a whole summer working on this, and then for years afterward tweaking it. But it's really only now when hearing it performed and working with the actors that I really feel like it's finished, in the sense that I now know that it's actable and entertaining, and that was something that I had always striven for, but I wasn't sure I could attain it. So this has been a really great moment for me.
And it's in rhyming verse. I'm thinking of a line I wrote down when I was watching last night. If you, for example, so this is a discussion in the Garden of Eden. If you eat from the apple of the tree, you'll reign in majesty, you'll be divinity. Was that the style at the time to also be in rhyming verse?
Yeah. In fact, rhyming verse was new when this play was written. Rhyme as a feature of poetry really only is invented in the 11th century and in old French dialects like that of the play of Adam. So the play really rejoices in the sonority of that rhyme. The problem is that, as most folks know, English is a much different language than French, and whereas there are so many words in French that rhyme very easily, it's much harder to translate those rhymes into English. So I really had to struggle quite a bit to because I wanted to keep the exact original rhyme schemes of the play, and that was one of the biggest puzzles for me.
So Kyle, this is staged in a church. Why?
Well, originally the stage directions included with the play talk about performing it in front of a church, and it's a little too cold this time of year for that. So we just premiered the Carol's translation at the Cloisters, the Met Cloisters in New York, as a part in their 12th century Fuente Dueña Chapel. And lovely space, just absolutely gorgeous. And it was really cool to be in a space that is roughly contemporary with the play itself. And the interior spaces of the church work beautifully, just as well as probably the exterior of the church would, too. With the play, we are able to gesture to whether they be sculptures or paintings. You probably saw last night the crucifix, the cross. We make gestures to them as a way to connect what it is we're saying, the biblical nature of it, and our audience there in the space with us to kind of the larger, grander ideas that the play is trying to communicate.
And I think the music of this also lends it to that, what you're talking about, really well. I wanted to play a little bit of what I recorded from the rehearsal I attended.
Behold, a virgin child conceived.
Drew, that's you, not just singing, but also composing and directing the trio. You coordinated all the music for this. How did you adapt all of the music for this production?
The play has specific rubrics in it. It's a number of chants that are come from a Sunday of Septuagesima. And these pieces actually are very available and remarkably consistent over several centuries. So I looked at several centuries of, they're called antiphonaries, that have these chants in them, and chose the simplest ones and simplified them more for the purposes of our play, partly because they're extremely long, and they were told, we're told in the script, in the original play, that they were sung by a choir. We have three singers. I think a choir can sustain these kinds of melismatic, very long lines better than we can as three singers. But also, I asked Carol if she would translate them into the same kind of nice, more vernacular sort of English, so that we would be able to match in that way. But the material itself is old. So in a way, we're using an old structure and renewing it. Now, what you just heard actually is, I have to make a little bit of a disclaimer about that, because that's actually written in a different style, because it comes at the ultimate moment of the show, when the show turns into a show as these early plays often do, about the birth of Jesus. It's very common for Old Testament stories to become suddenly New Testament stories at the end, as sort of a punchline, that all this is a preparation for Jesus, and that. So we were using that. Actually, in fact, what you just played is an introduction to a much longer piece that the cast sings with us as a sort of finale, musical finale.
So there's a lot of audience interaction with this, right? As you're talking about, Drew, as you're talking about the music and sort of the modern adaptation, Kyle, there's a whole part, especially at the beginning, with the devil. There's a lot of audience participation to sort of play along with the devil. Was that how the original play was? Is it something that you all came up with?
Very likely it was. These were plays that were meant not for clergymen or very wealthy, powerful people, but for the common folks of a town. The church would have been the community center and likely would have been attached to the center of the town or a town square of some type that people gathered for all types of religious and civic activity. So there's very strong emphasis on the community and on what people are dealing with on a daily basis. So when Adam and Eve lament having to sow their seeds and fight off the thorns and thistles, it's very much a call to those people that are doing the same kind of fights in their everyday life. And we really try to bring that in through the use of the devil and getting kids and young people involved to make noise with us. And as you mentioned earlier, we do make some gestures to a lot of what's going on in our contemporary world right now as a means to connect with our community here, not only when we did this in New York, but here at the University of Illinois.
So when you did this in New York, did you pass out buttons for Nasty Women?
We did. We okay. had Nasty Women stickers that we passed out. Lots of noisemakers in this beautiful, beautiful medieval museum. We were just making as much noise as we could.
And
it was a blast.
And the plan for this production is to include a reference. Did you add the last minute reference to the march, the women's march?
Carol should mention
Carol?
Talk about that, because that was her idea.
Yeah, so there's a a part in the play where Satan is tempting Eve, and the way she does it in the play is to say, you know, you deserve to be the ruler of this world. You are far smarter and more charismatic than Adam is, and you should be the equal of God. You could be the queen. And that's the moment where we're going to sort of whip out the nasty women and
more powerful than no man has ever seen,
exactly.
Or something like that. Yes.
So again, even this play, which is almost 1,000 years old, is already kind of introducing us to the sort of proto-feminist argument about women's power.
And is that in the original?
Oh, yeah.
That's in the original text as well.
I mean, obviously not nasty
women. Well, right,
but the whole notion of that. This whole idea that you know, Satan is a powerful psychologist, and what he figures out about Eve is that she's very smart and she's very ambitious, much more ambitious than Adam, and that's how she tries to make her argument to Eve. So it's a really interesting moment.
So Carol, this is an 11th century play. Is it about 11th century? A little earlier than that?
1100s. So the middle of the 12th century.
Okay. And what do we know about how it was staged, where it was staged, how common it was? What do we know about all of that?
Well, we only have one manuscript, but that's not at all unusual for medieval plays. Most medieval plays are hovering on the brink of extinction. So just the fact that we have one manuscript doesn't mean that it wasn't widely performed. There are all sorts of reasons why these texts wouldn't survive. But as Kyle mentioned, the stage directions in the play are so specific, and they talk about how the devil should interact with the audience. They talk about the importance of engaging the community. So the play really gives us a tremendous amount of information about how the playwright really envisioned it working. And in fact, we've added the playwright as a character in the play to interact with the actors and the musicians, just because the playwright, she seems to be so very present in the script. So really, this is, as Kyle says, we're never quite sure, but the play itself gives us so much information to work with.
And you play the role of the playwright.
I
want to get back to that in a second, but I want to just ask you about, Kyle, so you said originally, I'm just sort of thinking of the historical context of this, being performed outside a church. Is your sense then that this would have been something that entire communities would have attended? This wasn't something that was just for, as you said, the nobility or the clergy or things like that?
Well, one of the things that when Carol and I actually have been working on this play for a while, and I did a staged reading of it 2 or 3 years ago, and one of the things that Carol has put forward in her research with the play is that this was likely done by just a small number of performers, meaning that it could likely travel anywhere. And so it would have been the kind of thing that would have joined together a lot of smaller communities in a larger regional way. And we don't know, maybe different bits of the show could have been changed a little bit here and there to match with those regionalities. But one of the things that we've shown in our staging of it is that, yes, this with the numerous
characters
really
just
that we
four,
have,
there's really four.
There's only four actors.
Right.
It's an ensemble
show.
And
there's 16
different roles, they play different characters, but they play all the different characters. They're able to make their exits and their entrances and do any costume changes or any props adjusting that needs to be done fairly easily. And we've proven that now twice since the stage reading and now with this production as well. So I very much think, and this is my guess here, is that this would have been the kind of show that a small number of itinerant players could have traveled around the French countryside and hit a few good big, you know, villages here and there, but, you know, would have adjusted here and there to the different regional perspectives that may have been prominent at the time period, but also kind of bringing them all under larger issues and concerns, both theological, religious, communal, that the play deals with in a much bigger kind of regional sense.
And Drew, the music, would the music also have been something that people, the style that you, we heard a little bit of it, is that something everybody would have been familiar with as well?
Not really. It would have been educated, clerics probably. There would have been a choir, however, at any large cathedral or even church in a regional setting that would have known these chants. And that's why I found it interesting when I started doing the research on the specific pieces that are mentioned to find that actually I looked at settings all the way from Austria to France and 12th to 14th century settings. And even the 14th century settings you would expect to be much more elaborate, but no, they were really pretty codified. So they would have sung probably very close to the same notes. All we've done is simply tweaked it a little bit. I wouldn't say for modern taste really so much. as for convenience of the show. Because we are in this kind of set, you know, audiences sit on their hands in a way that I don't believe a 12th century
modern
audience
audiences
did.
Do.
Correct.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Oh, you know, terrified to be called on and use a rattle.
Right. Medieval
right.
audiences are
we are encouraging rowdy. Them, but it's very difficult. You know, we're used to going to see theater in a dark room where we don't, you know, if we laugh. Even,
a dark, cold
know.
Room normally,
well,
I would
right.
say.
And one of our neighbors, you know, chides us for even laughing at the show, much less for opening a candy. I think the reception that the audience would have had to this piece and the interaction was clearly more. But the music, I think, is in a way set aside. It's a sort of moment of repose as it, right. I mean, it even looks like that right. in the original.
Yeah, in fact, what the music does, it's so beautiful, is that the music returns us to the sacred story and to the liturgy.
The liturgy.
Whereas the play kind of makes that pop out. Mm-hmm. So there's that liturgical framework that reminds you that we're talking about the sacred story, but the dialogue connects that sacred story to what Kyle was talking about, to the everyday concerns of normal men and women right. who are trying to make a living in tough circumstances, dealing with marital issues, you know, dealing with sibling rivalry, you know, so that the play does so many things at once. It tells a sacred story, but it also makes that sacred story completely available to the common person.
I think if we're taking liberties with the music in the show, it's in introducing instrumental music, for which there's no proof. But in a way, Kyle and I were just talking about, last night we had a very fevered discussion about television and film, and how important the introduction of music is as an atmosphere, as an atmospheric component to continue the dialogue, to continue the storyline and support that. And I think that's what we've used the music for. The instrumental music doesn't even make an effort to be authentic to the time. First of all, we have extremely little instrumental music written down. So what I'm using that is truly true instrumental music comes from a later source.
So what you've adapted. So, you know, we just have a minute or two left. And Carol, I just wanted to ask you what you think the point of staging the play of Adam was in medieval times and how much what you want it to be now.
Mm-hmm. So drama was in the Middle Ages. It was the mass medium of the time. So if you wanted to teach people about politics or involve them in new educational trends, that was the way you did it. And so the play tackles controversial issues. It tackles the fact that many people might not have believed in certain elaborate theological concepts. We have a character in this play who questions the virgin birth, you know, whether that actually happened. In other words, the play it stages the kinds of doubts and problems that everyday people have. So that's one of the amazing things that this play does. And at the same time, it gives them beauty. It gives them something, you know, beautiful to listen to and look at. I think in many ways our intent nowadays is no different. We want to engage an audience. We want to fill them with joy and delight. We want to make them think. And we want to collapse the difference that we think exists between ourselves and people who lived in the 12th century, because these are human beings who are smart and hopeful, but also sinful and worried about contemporary events. You know, they're dealing with the same kinds of things that we are, in a way that's slightly so, and so that we're more united by those concerns than divided.
That's the play of Adam. Thanks to Carol Symes, who teaches in the Department of History, Theater, and Medieval Studies at the University of Illinois, plays the playwright, stage director Kyle A. Thomas, music director and composer Drew Minter, who also lectures at Vassar College. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much,
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. From the Bean in Millennium Park to the Picasso near Daley Plaza, Chicago is a city that's known not just throughout Illinois, but the world for its public art. And this year, 2017, Mayor Rahm Emanuel has proclaimed to be the year of public art in Chicago. This year, the city's commissioned dozens of local artists to create new sculptures, murals, and other public art pieces in all 50 wards of the city. It's a $1 million investment in artist-led community projects. It's all going to be highlighted during the month of October at a citywide public art festival. Blair Kamen is the architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune. He's in studio with me now at Northwestern's Mendel School of Journalism in downtown Chicago to talk about this. Hey, Blair, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nala. It's great to be here.
You know, I'm thinking about this. When I first moved to Chicago from Miami to go to Northwestern, to go to Mendel, it was during the Cows on Parade public art exhibit. And I just remember being so awed by it because I think prior to that, I was thinking about this when I was preparing for our conversation this morning. And I think prior to that, the only public art that I knew as a kid was when the crazy French artist Christo, he had like wrapped all the islands in Miami in pink plastic, which is sort of weird. But it got me thinking a lot about the concept of public art and how, especially for children, that's probably maybe their first sort of encounter with art, public art throughout the city. And I wanted to ask you about that and sort of what role you think public art plays in, especially here in Chicago.
Public art plays a big role in civilizing the city. When you think about architecture and art, what's the difference between them? Buildings shape space. They act together or they form walls, like the wall of skyscrapers along Wacker Drive or along Grand Park. Sculpture animates space. It puts creatures into space. It might be a flamingo, like we see in the Federal Plaza by Alexander Calder. It might be the Cows on Parade. It might be a general on horseback, or it might be a deer, like the deer, the larger-than-life-size deer that just showed up on the Riverwalk as part of this public art celebration. So that's the essential distinction. Architecture creates the environment. Sculpture populates it.
And when we think about that, there's something also, I think, about the ephemeral nature of public art in mm-hmm. some cases, right, that yeah. makes a big difference in the city as well. Because, and I'm thinking in particular of the walk you made to go from Tribune Tower across the bridge here. There's sort of that space in front of downtown Chicago between Tribune Tower and the NBC building where there's been, I think everyone, it's been a little controversial how good that public art has been, right? I think lots of visitors to Chicago remember the Marilyn Monroe statue that was there for a long time. Now it's a kind of an interesting Lincoln. How would you describe what
Abraham
is,
Lincoln like and some guy in sneakers?
Yeah. Okay, there we go. That's a good way to describe it.
I mean, the vulnerability, the temporary nature of public art and its vulnerability is also on display this year. And that's not something you're hearing about from the city of Chicago, which is just touting, you know, public art and how great the Emanuel administration is and how great the city is. For example, earlier this year, Alexander Calder's Universe, a mobile mechanized sculpture in the lobby of Willis Tower, disappeared. It was dismantled.
And that had been there forever.
That had been there since Willis Tower opened.
Yeah. It
had
been Sears Tower. We should.
Yes,
I like
correct.
That you say it's not. You're the architect. Okay, of course, you have to say Willis Tower.
Yeah,
everyone
no,
else will
but
say
it was,
Sears
no,
Tower.
But it was then Sears Tower. Right. Absolutely. So, in other words, there was an ownership dispute over that piece, and the it's complicated. But previous owners of Sears Tower, it's thought, had the piece removed, and so this whimsical, colorful piece that animated this kind of tall, rather cold and austere lobby just vanished. Then we learned about a piece of a mural in Pilsen that was a beloved piece of public art. And developers just graywashed it.
Right. I saw that, and I saw the sort of the outrage, particularly from a lot of artists that I know, but just a lot of people talking about that on social media.
It's stunning.
That's what you mean by vulnerability. When you say vulnerability, you mean because the public art is contingent on different commercial, like people who own the building or
yeah,
other commercial interests.
It's contingent upon the changing taste and the whims of owners of buildings. I mean, another good example was there was a wonderful Henry Moore piece in the lobby of 3 First National Plaza in Chicago. It was there for many years. Tourists still come to see it. They ask the security guards where it is. It's not there anymore. was moved to England a few years ago when the developer decided to redo the lobby. So, I mean, people have visceral, emotional attachments to
whether they love them or they hate them, they are visceral, aren't
right.
they?
Right. They're like people. They're like creatures. They you know, they really, if they're good, they get to us in some way. And ideally, if they're really good, we form attachments to them over the years. So when they disappear, it's like a beloved, you know, friend or feature of the cityscape has just vanished. And you say, why? What the hell's going on here?
I'm speaking with Blair Kamen, architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune, and we're talking about public art in Chicago. And when you say that about pieces in particular, the Picasso celebrated its 50th anniversary right. this year. And I love the line you had in your column. You wrote, then Mayor Richard J. Daley introduced this. This is in 1967, right? By saying, we dedicate this celebrated work with the belief that what is strange to us today will be familiar tomorrow, which is, yeah, really good. That's a really good aspiration. And turns out for that Picasso piece, which I think anyone who's driven by or been, or I mean, I think feel like anyone who's made any trip to Chicago has seen that. And then there's so many folks working around the Daley Center who see that piece. How did that piece kick off the whole notion of public art in Chicago?
That piece was commissioned from Picasso by a Chicago architect, William Hartman, who was very civic-minded. He traveled to Europe to meet with Picasso, and you know, he got Picasso to do this piece late in his career. And once that was there, it kind of was this way of breathing life into the Loop, which at that point was this kind of forest of skyscrapers. So the Picasso adorned this big plaza, this clearing in the forest, as it were, of open space. It, you know, in this clearing in the forest, there was this kind of inscrutable creature who might have looked like a basset hound.
I think still inscrutable to a lot of people,
yes.
I have to say, Blair.
Yeah. you know, angel's wings, a woman's face. It's certainly subject to interpretation. But all of a sudden, you know, this kind of became fashionable. And so then the General Services Administration, when it developed the Federal Center a few years later in the 1970s, commissioned Alexander Calder, one of the great sculptors of the 20th century, to do the flamingo. And the flamingo is just great. It's this vermilion-colored piece, Calder red, with curving steel that contrasts vividly with a kind of right-angled matte black architecture of the Mies van der Rohe buildings at the Federal Center. It's a fabulous counterpoint between the two. And it's interactive, like the Picasso. It isn't just a general on horseback that you walk around. You can walk through it. So it kind of anticipates through its interactivity features like the or sculptures, public sculptures like the Bean and the Crown Fountain that are really interactive, especially the Crown Fountain, where, you know, one can get a shower from the spitting
that's
gargoyles.
True interaction. And the Bean, which its official name,
Cloud
I should call
Gate,
it Cloud Gate, which
Anish
no
Kapoor.
One, which everyone calls it the Bean.
Right.
But I wonder when we think about, when we're thinking about this year of public art mm-hmm. with Mayor Emanuel, there are the sculptures and the pieces that are iconic to Chicago, certainly. And I think the Bean is sort of it in terms of tourists and coming downtown.
Yeah.
What is the hope that we'll see through neighborhoods throughout the Chicago with this year of art?
I think that the hope is that the pieces in the neighborhoods will create centers of, you know, visual focuses, centers of identity. Pieces that have the same sort of resonance that the destroyed Pilsen mural did in its neighborhood. People in Pilsen actually met and, you know, they were angry and they want to like repaint that mural
oh,
or recreate
yeah.
that mural. Mm-hmm. So I think that
which
that's...
Which is, I mean, I think, can we talk for a minute just about the role of murals in neighborhoods like Pilsen?
Sure.
Because I think that's a part of public art that maybe people who aren't as familiar with the city might not see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those murals were a vehicle for immigrant groups to, you know, express their identity, literally paint their identity on the walls of, you know, buildings. And they kind of layer on this identity on old Chicago residential or commercial buildings. And they just have great resonance over time because that's – it's like their flag. It's like their identity. So the loss of it – you know, people were literally laying flowers at the base of this mural that had been graywashed as though like someone had died. So, I mean, I think that, you know, ideally the neighborhood pieces are not what we call – what is often called derisively plop art. You know, just take it, make it, drop it in.
Right, doesn't reflect the neighborhood. It's people or it's
– Right, that it's that it engages in some way with the character of the neighborhood. And you know, that doesn't mean it has to blandly reflect the neighborhood. It might be provocative. But it – you know, ideally it has – some link, some connection. It isn't just dropped in by an artist, you know, who might have dropped it in somewhere else in another part of the city.
I wonder, what are your favorite pieces of public art in Chicago?
Well, as I've said, I love the Calder. Yeah. I love the Bean. I mean, who doesn't?
Who doesn't love right? The right?
Yeah, that's
I think that's a pretty universal,
that's,
right?
That's pretty easy, I have to admit.
Right.
I also love the Chagall mosaic. That is at the Chase Plaza. This is this piece that looks, you know, it has the kind of delicacy of, you know, peanut brittle or something. And it's this wonderful, very long wall of surrealistic sculpture by Chagall in which he depicts life in Eastern Europe, in Chicago. There are all these images of families, of lovers. And you know, it's right up against this skyscraper that's like, that looks like a ski slope. You know, it's like 50 or 60 stories tall. It kind of curves down to the bottom. And you've got this, you know, piece, again, contrasting with the architecture that's, you know, these beautiful little mosaic pieces that kind of have this jewel-like quality to them. And, you know, again, these pieces just, you know, they humanize the city. It's they're you know, like the cows, like the deer. They're either creatures or they have messages, and they are more in – they're not necessarily human scale, but they're more human scale than, you know, Willis Tower, the second tallest building in the country. So I think they become really – they really enrich the cityscape, and they enrich our experience of passing through it.
Speaking of that vulnerability, one last question I wanted to ask you about before we wrap. The Thompson Center, it's been sort of controversial. We're kind of in this back and forth phase. Is it going to be sold? Is it not?
Right.
That's another question about some art there.
Absolutely. There's a Jean Dubuffet sculpture in front of the Thompson Center. Monument Withstanding Beast is the name of it. And you know,
who owns that?
Well, the state of Illinois museum controls it. And they had been making contingency plans about possibly relocating it to another site if the Thompson Center were to be demolished, were to be sold and then demolished. Now, Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel's deal about the sale of the Thompson Center fell through. So for the present, the Thompson Center is safe, and so is the Dubuffet. But like all public art, it may wind up being vulnerable, and it may wind up being moved. We'll see.
That's the Chicago Tribune's architecture critic, Blair Kamen. We'll tweet out a few of the columns he's wrote recently this year about public art, but I want to thank him for being with us. Blair, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
No, it was a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Search for our Facebook page, Like the 21st. You can comment there, too, on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Bob Holly, and Alan Montecelio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance of the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.